For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. So Nebuchadnezzar, the guy that's been the emperor up till now, died in 563. So we're zooming fast forward. His son was called Evil-Merodach. Nice. You could name your son that, Evil-Merodach. Man of Marduk. Marduk was a principal god in their pantheon. Evil released the captive Jewish king Jehoiakim from prison and gave him an honorable seat at the court. That comes up in the book of 2 Kings, names him, and describes him doing that. So there's, again, multiple contact points in the history going on here. 2 years later, he was assassinated by his brother-in-law, Nergal-Sar. Nergal-Sar died just 4 months later, and his son, Labashe-Marduk, who succeeded him, was murdered 9 months after that. So a lot of murder. This revolt placed the leader of the revolt, Nabonidus, on the throne. He was not related. He was not a son of the royal line. He was a general, a military leader, led a coup. But he married one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters, and that way kind of legitimized his claim to the throne, that he was a king-in-law, whatever. The last 10 years of his life, he seems to have spent most of his time in this time on the Edomite or North Arabian capital, hundreds of miles away from Babylon. And we're not sure what he was doing over there all the time, but the was not seen around Babylon very much. The year now is 539. Well, here we read in Daniel 5, verse 1. Many years later, King Belshazzar gave a great feast for thousands of his nobles, and he drank wine with them. And so we have our first problem right here. That list of kings I gave you was exhaustive, and this name was not on there, right? Belshazzar. There's no such thing as a King Belshazzar. The king was Nabonidus at this time. And he was the last king of Babylon. And so this naming of an improper king has created quite a furor of criticism for Daniel. And liberal critics, naturalistic critics of Daniel are very hostile to the date and authorship of this book. Because if this book was actually written when it says it was, by who it says it was, then that means it was telling, that you'll see in the next few weeks, that means he was telling the future hundreds of years into the future, detailed. And that, of course, is not possible. If you're a naturalist, you don't believe in the supernatural, people cannot tell the future. So therefore, what is it? It's a forgery written after the fact, claiming it was ancient in 6th century, really written in the 2nd century around 165 B.C., so the things that he's predicting in the future were actually things that already happened. That's how he knew it. And a proof of that was that whoever wrote this book was so incompetent, he didn't even know who the last king of Babylon was. And they had lost track of that now, because you know that would be 250 years later in 165. They basically had lost track of the true succession of kings, which, you know, is not surprising. They didn't keep the kind of historical records that we do today. So that kind of thing could easily slip up. And so this is just, it just goes to show that you can't put much stock in a book that is fraudulent, that is late dated, and which really doesn't know the history of that period at all. Well, along comes 1850s AD, so 2,500 years almost after the story we're going to read tonight, archaeologists unearth the Nabonidus cylinder in the city of Ur. It's in the British Museum today. Here are, you can go and read about it on their website. Here's what the comment they have. It has two columns, each containing 31 lines, separated from each other by division rules. with very well-preserved and beautifully written Babylonian characters. It records the rebuilding of Sin's ziggurat. Sin was the name of one of their gods. it's the moon god. At the city of Ur by Nabonidus, who entreats the moon god to guard both him and his son, Belshazzar, from wrongdoing. Oh, good Lord. This was the first mention of Belshazzar other than the Bible anywhere. 2,500 years after the fact, digging up this cylinder, which was from that time, which was put there by Nabonidus, the emperor, turns out his son, Belshazzar. And now we found his name on numerous other monuments and other cylinders, and no one really disputes anymore that Nabonidus was a co-regent, that is, a co-reigning with Nabonidus. Nabonidus was in the west over in Edom and left his son running the show in Babylon. Daniel. So what had been a grounds for attack against Daniel suddenly became amazing evidence of the truthfulness and value of Daniel, because no one else remembered this. We didn't have a single word about this guy except Daniel for 2,500 years. And lo and behold, he was the one that was in the right. Awesome. And so we should remember that, because, you know, ancient texts may mention events, people, things that we cannot independently verify. But our knowledge in history is extremely fragmentary. That's an argument from silence to say, well, we can't show any other source that backs us up, so therefore that's a false statement. That's just bad reasoning. And arguments from silence don't prove anything. And so there are some other points in Daniel that can't be independently verified today. Most of them, though, can. And so the credibility of Daniel in that sense has soared. How would a guy writing in 165, where no history existed of this man in circulation, how would a guy in 165 know that the last guy sitting there was Belshazzar? Really doesn't fit that theory very well at all. Ow. Okay. Notice, too, that even in the text of Daniel, it's clear that Belshazzar is not actually the emperor. When he's trying to give someone the ultimate reward, he says that whoever can interpret this will become the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That's weird. He usually would say the second highest, right? He can't say the second highest. That's him. I'm the second highest. I can give you the third place in the kingdom. He's not the emperor. He is the co-regent. Oh, thank you, God. It's awesome to see your word vindicated. Let's keep reading. Well, while Belshazzar was drinking the wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver cups that his predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem. He wanted to drink from them with his nobles, his wives, and his concubines. And so they bring in the sacred vessels from the temple of God in Jerusalem, which had been captured. And the king and his nobles and his wives drank from them. And while they drank from them, they praised their idols made of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. And so, again, we have an arrogant Babylonian monarch defying God. This is just like giving God the finger. And rejoicing, they knew what these vessels were. They knew who they had to do with. That it was the God of Israel and the biblical God. And they're just flaunting. Yeah, and you know, taking these vessels that were for the priests and their worship that they would carry out, and holding up, and they're mocking God here. Mocking him, daring him to do anything about it. Archer points out pagans' gods are described as the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone because to the Hebrew monotheists, these materials, these objects, are all the substance the pagan gods had. As products of pagan imagination, these gods had no real being. They're not the living God. And so we see derision like that in many of the prophetic books. Why are you kneeling there praying to a stone that you carved? You know, it's so crazy. Yeah, idol worship. And so the stage is set for God as he can, to basically reassert. And in each of these, it's very similar to the early couple of stories we read. People are raging and shaking their fists at God, and God comes back in and then reasserts his authority, partly to make a statement to his own people, tens of thousands of whom are prisoners here in this city. He doesn't want them to lose them because he's still going to carry on his plan with the Jewish people, and he's going to get them back in their country again. And so he doesn't want them, you know, losing heart and falling away. So he's willing to step up and do some pretty miraculous things to keep them confident. Well, suddenly they saw the fingers of a human hand writing on the plaster wall of the king's palace near the lampstand. The king himself saw the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale with fright. His knees were knocking together in fear. His legs giving way beneath him. Yeah, you don't see this very often with the hand. That'd be quite a shock. The whole place apparently came to the party, this drunken brawl they were having, an orgy. Everything comes to a halt. The music, the dancing girls stood motionless. The waiters stopped short, all gazing at the words on the wall. Well, we read the king shouted for the enchanters, the astrologers, fortune tellers to be brought before him. And he said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever can read this writing and tell me what it means will be dressed in purple robes of royal honor and will have a gold chain placed around his neck. He'll become the third highest ruler in the kingdom. There it is. Well, third highest. That's the best he could do. But when all the king's wise men had come in, none of them could read the writing or tell him what it meant. Nothing. So the king grew even more alarmed. His face turned pale. His nobles, too, were shaken. This whole scene just doesn't look good. But when the queen heard what was happening, she hurried to the banquet hall. Now, wait a minute. It said he was there with his wives and his concubines. Who's this? It's not his wife. It's Nabonidus' wife. She's the queen. His mother-in-law. And that's why she was not in this part. She's an older, probably old lady. She comes down. Long live the king. Don't be so pale and frightened. There's a guy in your kingdom who has within him the spirit of the holy gods. During Nebuchadnezzar's reign, this man was found to have insight, understanding, wisdom like that of the gods. This man, Daniel, whom you, the king, named Belshazzar, who the king named, that has exceptional ability and is filled with a divine knowledge of understanding. He can interpret dreams, explain riddles, solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he'll tell you what the writing means. The best estimate, Daniel is old by now. He started this as a young teenager. We're now over 65 years later. He's anywhere from 75 to 85 years old, which was really old for people back then. And people did live that long, but it was pretty unusual. Well, they fetch him up. Daniel was brought before him. The king said, are you Daniel, one of the exiles brought from Judah by my predecessor, King Nebuchadnezzar? I've heard you have the spirit of the gods within you, and you can, you're filled with insight, understanding, and wisdom. And he goes on through, my wise men and enchanters have tried to read the words on the wall, and they tell me their meaning, but they can't do it. I'm told you can give interpretations, solve difficult problems. If you can read these words and tell me their meaning, I'm going to give you the cloth, the chain of gold, the honor, the third place in the kingdom. Well, Daniel's like, keep your gifts or give them to someone else, okay? I don't want your gifts. Obviously, Daniel didn't want to be enriched, didn't want people saying he was enriched by this no good anti-God dude. And he says, I'll tell you what the writing means. Your Majesty, the Most High God gave sovereignty, majesty, glory, and honor to your predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar. He made him so great that people of all races and nations and language trembled before him in fear. He killed who he wanted to kill, and he spared who he wanted to spare. He honored those he wanted to honor, disgraced those he wanted to disgrace. But when his heart and mind were puffed up in arrogance, then he was brought down from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. And that's, of course, the story we read last week where he went out like a wild animal. He recounts that whole thing again. So he says, you're his successor, Belshazzar, and you knew all of this. Yet you have not humbled yourself. You've proudly defied the Lord of heaven and have had these cups from his temple brought before you. And your defiance and the pride, that is what God finds extremely offensive here. You and your nobles, your wives, concubines, all been drinking wine from these cups while praising the gods of silver, gold, and so forth. Gods that neither see nor hear or know anything at all. But you have not honored the God who gives breath of life and controls your destiny, the real God, the living God. You're mocking him and worshiping these objects that you've made that are not even real. So God sent his hand to write this message. And this message that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is what it means, he says. Mene means numbered. God has numbered the days of your reign and has brought it to an end. Tekel means weighed. You've been weighed in the balances and have not measured up. And Parson means divided. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Well, Belshazzar came through. He must have borne witness to that prophecy. Interesting that Herodotus, the Greek historian, writing about 70 or 80 years after this, from 450 BC, describes when the Persians took Babylon. They got inside by diverting the Euphrates River, which actually went right under the walls of the city. And when the river went down, it opened up a way in, these 100-foot tall walls they had. And they had soldiers in there and got to the gate and got it opened. And the Babylonians realized they were screwed because they were greatly outnumbered. And so they just dropped their weapons and fled. And so they wound up taking the city without a fight. But Herodotus says that the nobles were having a party and completely oblivious that their city was being taken over as they moved in, and actually confirms this story. I don't think he got it from Daniel. There's no sign that Herodotus read Daniel. And Daniel was not internationally known book. It was strictly within the Hebrew tradition, but as they both refer to the fact that as Cyrus's people were invading, Cyrus himself wasn't with them at the time, it was one of his generals, and taking the city, that they had a big brawl, drunken brawl going on. Wow. And we read, that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. Bye. Nothing more to say about him. And so then Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. And so we have another name that doesn't belong here. The guy that received the kingdom, his name was Cyrus, okay? First emperor of the Persian Empire. And there's nothing about Darius. There is an emperor named Darius, but he's like the third or fourth down the line. Again, Daniel, so confused, whoever he is, this specious writer in the Maccabean era, didn't know that Darius was not the first emperor. He thought he was the first one. He's actually the fourth one. Or the third. I actually forget which one. Third or fourth. Of course, this is not Darius the emperor. This is Darius the Mede. Darius the emperor was a Persian. He's obviously calling him Darius the Mede to distinguish him from that better known Darius. And again, once again, a similar type of thing happened where in excavations in modern times, we were able to discover that Cyrus, who was still campaigning in the West, left a viceroy in charge of Babylon, and they called him Gubaru, and this is him, Darius the Mede. He's serving as a king, a local king. He's like a king-in-law. Well, it seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom. And then over them, three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one. So Daniel has become one of the top three guys in the whole province there. And they would oversee and be accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. So these guys could get busted out by the commissioners, including one of them was Daniel. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Darius the Mede, he likes Daniel, likes his work. And then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful. And no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. And so we have jealousy. They're going to form a conspiracy to try to get Daniel because they're jealous that he's exceeding them. The men said, "We'll not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against his, with regard to his love of his God and the law of his God." Then the commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king, to Darius, and spoke to him as follows. "King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and satraps, high officials, and everyone else consulted. And we think the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man beside you, O king, for 30 days should be cast into the lion's den." Executed by lion. "Now, okay, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked." And therefore, King Darius signed the document. And so, just to pause right here, we have a couple of more interesting historical accuracies in this text. Remember that Nebuchadnezzar threw people into a fire to execute them into a blazing furnace. The Persians considered fire sacred and would not use it for execution. And so it's realistic that they would use a lion's den instead. Also, this detail is put in here that once it goes into signed into law, it cannot be revoked. Is now known to be exactly the case. Whereas somebody like a Nebuchadnezzar could make one decree and just reverse it the next day, and there was nothing anyone could say about that. Total absolute monarch. That was not the case with the Persians. And when they signed one of these decrees into law, even the king himself could not change it. So it was a very unusual, really, for a monarch, an emperor, to have that kind of limitation. But we know that that is the case. Daniel had it right. Then they answered and they spoke before the king. "Daniel, who's one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed. But he keeps making his petition to God three times a day." He must have been doing this right out where people could see it. He's on his knees praying. "Then, as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself trying to rescue him." So Darius doesn't want to see Daniel get wasted. He likes him. And yet, he signed that thing. And the guys come back, the conspirators come back by agreement to the king. They said, "Recognize, O king, it is a law of the Medes and Persians, and that no injunction statute which the king establishes may be changed. You have to comply with your own law." And so we read, the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke, said to Daniel, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, himself will deliver you." And the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. He's really bent out of shape that they flipped Daniel into that lion's den. Well, the king arose at dawn, at the break of day, and went out in haste, first thing, to the lion's den. He got up near to the den to Daniel and cried out in a troubled voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Then Daniel spoke to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me." And so then the king was very pleased. He gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. And so Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury was found on him because he had trusted in God. And of course, Darius by now, pissed. And the king then gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. And when they, before they had reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed their bones. Okay, just remember, this is description, not prescription, okay? This is a heathen emperor who's pissed. And so he throws even the kids in there. Savage. This is not God's will, okay? And very often, whether it's the Old Testament or the New, and the Bible will just record events as they happen. You're supposed to know enough to know right from wrong. And obviously, the wives and children were not guilty here. They hadn't done anything. But, boom, there it is. Then he turns around and makes this decree that in all the dominion of my kingdoms, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. Notice he hasn't really become a believer. It's not my God. It's Daniel's God. For he is the living God, enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. Ironically, mirroring the message of the book of Daniel. And so, we've made it through both stories. What are we to draw? One of the things you see in these stories is the fallenness of humanity. And you can analyze the fallen nature of humans. The Bible teaches that humanity is an abnormal, broken state. We are not what we were created to be. We have that high level of being created in the image of God, of having high order consciousness, moral culpability because of our free will, and so forth. But so there are some very noble, brilliant, spectacular features of humanity, but it is poisoned fatally with the self-centeredness and the sin that resulted when humans turn away from God. That's what's called the fall. They fell from grace. And one of the things that really marks the fallen nature is the pride that humans have. Very proud of what they've accomplished. So, of course, the kind of guys like Belshazzar, you know, he's already being glorified as a monarch, a king, and everything else. That's not enough. He has to go further and tweak the ear, you know, of God and vault himself up over God himself, just like Nebuchadnezzar did the same thing. Pride. And in the garden, when Satan attacked humans for the first time, one of the things he promised them, he says, "You can become like God." And that had a lot of appeal. That still does. To become the greatest human around, pretty cool. To become a God, even cooler. I wonder if some of that desire for power and awesomeness might be linked to the superhuman superhero what should we call it, frenzy, dare we say, today? What is it that's so appealing about superheroes? They're kind of godlike. They can fly, they can zap people, they can do anything. It's kind of, they're superhuman. Well, that's a fantasy that people have in general, and then occasionally you find them literally. Here we are with Darius, literally saying you can't ask anyone, including any god, you can only ask me. Well, it was only for 30 days, but still, as some sort of a joy trip to be like the ultimate dude for 30 days. Well, humility is the antithesis of pride. And when Jesus came, he humbled himself. We read, he really was a king. He really is King Jesus at the right hand of God the Father, and lived in unapproachable light. And he humbled himself and he emptied himself. He went the opposite direction of what we're reading about in these cases. So in the kingdom of God, the way up is down. Jesus came and taught that we needed to be the same way. That if we want access to him and his free gift, the first thing and the most difficult thing to overcome is human pride. He says in Matthew 18, whoever then humbles himself like this child, he was holding a child at the time, he's greatest in the kingdom of heaven. A child, little child. Yeah, you know, even when they're saying, oh, look what I can do. There's something pure about it. They don't have this ego that needs to be better than everyone else and so forth. That all comes later. And you see this with little children, just this lack of guile, lack of self-focus in that sense of pride. Jesus says you need to become like that. Well, people look at the offer for Christ and they're like, well, I feel like, I'm not sure I need to be forgiven. I'm not sure I need to, grovel. You know, I feel like I'm pretty good. I've never killed anyone. You know, I try to be true to myself. Yeah, well, to come to Christ, that's just not going to be good enough. If you want what Christ has, Paul says, people that come to Jesus with pride, he's like, I got nothing for you. In 1 Corinthians 1, Paul explains, we proclaim Christ crucified. To Jews, a stumbling block. They think that's really stupid. To Gentiles, foolishness. What? A crucifixion victim? And you're saying we're supposed to bow to that? A naked, disgraced corpse on a tree? And Paul says, that's what we proclaim. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. The greatest glory that God has is when he humbles himself like Jesus did. Jesus' humbling of himself, his voluntary going to the cross to pay for human sin, was the biggest statement. I mean, that was probably shows us the nature of God more than any other thing. You know, that's like the ultimate value there of self-giving love instead of trying to grasp for self and funnel praise and glory into me. Yeah. Well, God is glorious. You know, he's very glorious. But he is more, all of his needs are already met. He can meet any need he has instantly. He's totally self-existent. So what is it like to live like that, where, you know, you can no more think of, I feel like a beer right now and one's in your hand. You know, it's like you would never be aspiring to anything. And the answer is that you get interested in what you can give out. Because you don't need to take anything in. You got everything you want or could imagine. And that's the way God is. He's a giver. He's a lover. John says that God is love. And that those who love know God and have met him. So that's something we can come away from these stories with. Not to follow this defiant, proud pathway, which leads directly away from the true relationship to God, but to do what Jesus suggested. Become as humble as a little child and come to him and just admitting, I need you, I need to be forgiven, I'm not good enough, and just receive the gift of Christ. Yeah. All right, we're going to draw the line there. God, Daniel was such a spiritual stud. It's just amazing to think of a guy this consistent and to be so unintimidated to come in and just dress down a king like he did there. Incredible boldness, God. Incredible consistency, fearlessness that faith in you really brings. We just pray for that, God. We long to have those traits ourselves. We long, God, to understand true humility, and we trust you to teach it to us. Show us, God, your love and your humility, because that's what we're going to follow. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.